are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, May 6, 2019. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, national political correspondent for the Washington Post, Dave Weigel, will be with us to talk about what he's seeing on the trail. Also on the program today, new report. Humans are destroying the planet and all other life. Sorry about that. Also on the program today, Bill Barr fails to comply with a subpoena. Democrats to vote on contempt Wednesday. Meanwhile, on that campaign trail, Bernie introduces a trust-busting agricultural plan. Booker releases a gun control plan. And Biden has a plan to save our souls. Also on the program today, polls suggest 2020 turnout will be huge, but Dems have lost their enthusiasm advantage. Meanwhile, Bolsonaro gets deplatformed by New York City. The Trump administration writes new rules to allow healthcare workers to freely discriminate against non-Christians, LGBTQ folks, and women seeking abortions. U.S. sends a carrier strike force in a warning to Iran and perhaps to Americans that we may be launching a war with Iran. And lastly, John Kelly wants to remind you the so-called adults in the Republican Party, also scumbags. All this and more on today's program. Yeah, the John Kelly story is really atrocious. We will get to that later, but it is what you would imagine in many respects. We will talk about that. We will talk about those plans that have been released. And talk a little bit about the question of to impeach or not to impeach implicates the Democrats' power to enforce a subpoena. The bottom line is, in the context of impeachment hearings, a congressional subpoena has far more weight, according to the Supreme Court, than just in its function of oversight. There are limited options that Congress can pursue in seeking to, or I guess, enforce a contempt finding against someone in contempt of Congress. The last time Congress imprisoned someone for being in contempt of Congress was 1935, if I'm not mistaken. And they could theoretically hold someone, and I think there's like a jail in Congress, a couple of jail cells, they could hold them until the end of the term. And then at the new term, they get released. So I'd like to see Bill Barr in prison there. I mean, that would be fun if you could be as part of the Capitol tour, too, if you could walk through and see him down there. I mean, I know I am... You know, I do have problems with the carceral state, but there are certain situations where I make a broad exception for people I would like to see put in jail.
Well, if we're going to have a carceral state, we might as well use it on those people.
Yeah, point it in the right direction.
That is one of the things, too, I'm thinking about, because, I mean, you do have these prisons, these jails in Congress, and it's one of those, like, use them or lose them type of situations, as far as I'm concerned. So Bill Barr in jail, That I feel like would be enough for me to take a trip down with the kids to visit the Capitol. In the meantime,
tall, that's Bill Barr.
There you go, kids. Don't feed him. Hey, speaking of kids, Mother's Day is coming up, and there's nothing we wouldn't do to make sure the special moms in our lives are happy. Even the non-special moms.
Yeah, I was going to. I didn't want to interrupt the flow, but that did stick out to me.
I think, you know, all.
I thought all of them were.
I mean, really, everybody's special, but on Mother's Day, moms sense. Are particularly special.
It's not deserving moms and undeserving moms.
Right. However, Sherry's Berries has special Mother's Day's berries designed just for mom. They're topped with chocolate chips, pink shimmer sugar, and swizzles. I took a picture of the ones that we had that came in here.
That's and the closest before I'm going to get to
before
trying
you
them.
Vanquish them.
I realized I
without letting anybody else touch
I was
them.
Tipping that you I had like, eaten them
click.
All. And
so good.
And you choose your delivery date to ensure that mom gets your gift of Sherry Berries exactly when you want her to. Look, you only have like 5 days left, so get on it today. Better yet, your satisfaction is always guaranteed. These berries are huge. They're delicious. The chocolate is awesome. I don't know what more I can say. They're delicious, and
they looked amazing.
They work even for fathers, but they're particularly for mothers just this day. But don't wait to the last minute on this one, folks. Do not sleep on this. Visit berries.com, berries.com today to order freshly dipped strawberries starting at $19.99 for the mom or moms in your life. Give it to your grandma, too. Give it to your aunt. Give it to your sisters. Give it to your daughters. To make mom really happy, you can double the berries for just $10 more. Mother's Day is Sunday, May 12th. Double the berries, folks, so that everybody's going to eat them. Visit berries.com. That's berries.com. Then click on the microphone in the upper right-hand corner. Enter my code, CEDAR, based on my name, CEDAR, S-E-D-E-R. That's berries.com. Click on the microphone. Code CEDAR, spelt like Seder. I don't know why we do that, but the Cedars do that. All right, here is Dennis Prager. And, of course, Dennis Prager, highly, very supportive of Dave Rubin, right?
Hello.
They do Prager University.
Too often, people are not interested in ideas.
Hello.
That was Dennis Prager speaking to Dave Rubin's face.
There you go.
Doing that voice.
And longtime listeners will remember Indie Mike. This is Indie Mike's favorite program, the Dennis Prager Show. And because he listens to both sides. He listens to Prager and to Ann Coulter. And here is Prager. And just, gosh, boy, living the life. I mean, right-wing talk radio. What a... Talk about being on the dole. Like, he doesn't even do any. He's just sort of just rambling here. But the point is he's trying to make is, folks, is that racism, at least the notion of racism that we would have some type of white supremacy in this country or that black people are that black people are subjected to racism in any way, that's a myth. I mean, if this sounds familiar to you, you've probably heard Dave Rubin talking to... what's her name? Southern? Lauren Southern? You know, nodding in agreement that Jewish groups in Canada basically created the Nazi groups up there so that they'd have something to rail against because, you know.
Funding opportunities.
Right. Just going to.
Maybe this to
just
be
going
fair.
To synagogue and going and celebrating the holidays gets a little boring for Jews. And so everybody wants to fight some Nazis.
Passover's so sleepy. Can we have some skinheads around here?
Anyways. But here is Dennis Prager, and then sort of like, you know, pulling out of God knows where they got this story. I imagine it's true because statistically speaking, how could it not be true that there isn't someone giving a lecture somewhere in which you disagree with the premise? But here is Dennis Prager, stylings.
And that is what the left does. Hysteria, crisis after crisis. Crisis. Black American is elected president, and the country is declared more racist than ever. the crisis of racism in America. But there's so little racism in America, except anti-white racism, that it's all made up. To the extent that there's a professor going around from Washington State.
Pause it. I just want to point out now, one of the things that I've been told by Indy Mike about what's so great about this guy is all logic. And so just to follow here, despite the fact that we elected a black president in this country, which actually all the data shows ended up creating a lot of racial polarization because it turns out there was a lot of white people who surprisingly did not realize like that the Democratic Party was to the left on race than the Republican Party. And they felt that this was in many respects a metaphor for everything that they were losing in life, whether some of that was real and as a function of our the structure of our economy or imagined or real in terms of like loss of social status. They began to more intensely blame the existence of black people. But as you heard, the only real racism that we still have in this country, according to Dennis Prager, is, of course, white racism, which is shocking, despite the fact that we now have a white president.
Hello.
I proved that. And I proved white racism, anti-white racism is done. And I proved it. I was elected president.
Well, there it's is crazy. Backlash to the white president.
That's true. But we've had so many white presidents, and now white racism is finally catching up with all those white presidents. I mean, it's sort of amazing how many white presidents we've had, but yet the durability in Dennis Prager's mind of white racism, that's pretty impressive. Anyways, continue.
It's all made up. To the extent that there's a professor going around from Washington State, I reported her name and everything, but it's just another one of these hysterics, making good money lecturing on campuses about how anyone who says I treat everyone the same or I try to treat everyone the same is a racist. Get it? Because there is no racism, they have to manufacture, or excuse me, there is racism. There's so little racism. They have to manufacture racism where it doesn't exist.
I'll give him this. He does not sound like a hysteric.
No.
I have to say that my brain is still in recovery mode from taking in so many high-level important ideas.
There
People
you go.
Think we have a lot of long pauses on this show.
Right. And at least at the end of it, maybe I'm saying something. He's just going, it's...
Oh, look at Sammy
racism.
With his, like, at least maybe
racism.
Also, I get it pointed.
And it's...
That would be funny if Sam...
No racism.
No, and Sam's more keyed up. He'd be like... And, of course, the only racism in is the anti-white racism, as we know. Now, ostensibly...
Oh, God. Well, that's why we started doing Ken, Ken, and Ken, because it's just so easy to be a right-wing talker.
Great.
So easy. Great. So easy. And...
Let's just do you. Great.
So easy.
Welcome back.
Exactly. I can't believe how much white racism I ran into today. I everywhere I went, people were, you know, maligning me because I was so white.
There was another professor. Another hysteric. I don't know his name. Totally.
But he was a man, of course. Of course he was a white man. So, oh, he gets in trouble. When are the white people going to get a break around here? God. All right. Anyways. Hey, folks, whether you're trying to get a sweet deal on something or find the best happy hour in town, you know it's a good idea to read the reviews first. Right? Well, why would you? Why should finding the right software for your business be any different? Read thousands of real software reviews and find the right software for your business at Capterra.com/majority. Capterra is the leading free online resource to help you find the best software solution for your business with over 850,000 reviews of products from real software users in more than 700 categories of software, from project management to email marketing, and is everything you need to make an informed decision fast. Join the millions of people who use Capterra each month to find the right tools for their business. I've told you, like, I literally, I will spend time on the Capterra website, just reading about all the different types of software that exist out there, just because I didn't even realize there were this many jobs that you could have. But things like hospice software or HR analytics software, idea management software, that actually is pretty good. Identity management software, insurance ratings, I'm just in the eyes. Investment management software, investigation management software, IoT software. I don't even know what that means. iPad kiosk software.
IoT is Internet of Things.
Is that right?
Yep.
I don't even know what that means.
Your fridge has Wi-Fi.
Oh, is that right?
You turn on your fridge or your eyeball, white boy.
IWMS software. I don't know what it is, but somebody out there knows. If you run a jail management software. Job evaluation software, job shop software, kiosk software, key management software, laboratory information. I mean, it goes on and on and on. It's sort of amazing. You can visit Capterra.com/majority for free today to find the tools to make an informed software decision for your business. You go check it out because it may even be software for your business you didn't even realize existed. Capterra.com/majority. That's Capterra, Capterra.com/majority. Capterra software selection simplified. And lastly, it may feel like a cybercrime is something that happens to other people, but stealing data from unsuspecting people on public Wi-Fi is one of the simplest ways for hackers to make money. When you leave your internet connection unencrypted, you might as well be writing your passwords and credit card numbers on a huge billboard for the whole world to see. I'm talking to you who goes and hangs out at that coffee shop. Or you go into wherever it is you go, where, you know, like you get a muffler change, you get on the software at Midas. I don't know what company it would be, whatever. It doesn't matter. You got to protect yourself today with ExpressVPN. ExpressVPN secures and anonymizes your internet browsing by encrypting your data and hiding your public IP address. ExpressVPN has easy-to-use apps that run seamlessly in the background of your computer, phone, and tablet. Turning on ExpressVPN protection only takes one click, and it costs less than $7 a month. ExpressVPN is rated the number one VPN service by TechRadar and comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee. Protect your online activity today and find out how you can get 3 months free at expressvpn.com/majority. That's ExpressVPN, ExpressVPN.com/majority for 3 months free with the 1 year package. Visit ExpressVPN.com/majority to learn more. Check it out, folks. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk to somebody who spends an inordinate amount of time away from home going to campaign rallies. And so if you want to know what's actually happening on the trail, this is the guy to talk to, which is why we will be talking to him. We'll be right back with Dave Weigel.
The artist knew their faces well, the husbands of his lady friends, his creditors and counselors, in armor bright the merchant men, official moments of the guild and poses keen from bygone days, city fathers frozen there upon the canvas, dark with age. Paint a flask of wine and turn those faces all to me. The blunderbuss and halberd shaft of Dutch respectability. They make their entrance one by one, defenders of that way of life. Red brick home, the bourgeoisie, and guitar lessons for the wife. We'll be right back.
We are back, Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program a Washington Post political correspondent and author of the not necessarily political, The Show That Never Ends, The Rise and Fall of Prog Rock. Welcome to the program, Dave.
It's good to be back. Thank you.
We did play King Crimson to lead you in, and that was Matt wanted you to know that he did that specifically for you.
Yeah, I didn't hear it exactly, but I usually go back and listen to the tape of the show 5 or 6 times to hear my own voice, so I'll hear it in the replay.
Yeah, exactly. As long as you you'll have that, and you could piece it together and create almost a full song.
Yeah.
That could be your Spotify awesome. Playlist. All right, so Dave, you've been on, and I am a subscriber to your email, missive, the trailer, which people can subscribe to at the Washington Post. We'll put a link to that. And it really gives me a sense of, well, the sense that you're getting on the campaign trail. So, up to this point, tell us, where you have been, just so that we get a notion of, what you're... what your sample size is, or where you're reporting from?
Well, let's see. The last few weeks was Las Vegas, where there was an SAIU sponsored event on wages and workers. I was in Houston for the She the People event. I was with a couple of candidates solo. I was with Warren in Vegas with Biden on the trail, and I took a couple of days to kind of reset and refocus on here. But at this point, everyone who's running for president, except for Michael Bennett, I have, and I guess Wayne Messam, is depending on the week, and I forgot that candidate, is different. Those guys aside, I've seen everybody on the trail, so I've got a pretty good set of data to compare.
I did not even know that Wayne Messam was running, and so I appreciate it.
Yeah, you got to mention him. He's just the mayor of a small city in Florida who's also running for president, apparently.
Apparently Bill de Blasio is going to jump in, too. Maybe we can talk about that in a moment. But as you come back from this, what strikes you first about the people who are attending all these rallies in terms of the voters? Mm-hmm.
Well, there's not a lot of hard ideological opinions from the people who kind of self-select and show up to political rallies. For a very long time in 2018, there aren't really rallies for people running for Congress till the very end. It was a lot more going out with a canvas or going to a debate, things like that. And the people who are interested in politics were showing up to small meetings, working with individual candidates. The rallies they're bigger crowds. I think if you average together everybody's crowds, there's never been this many candidates getting big audiences for Democrats. I would say Biden, Sanders, Harris, and Warren and Buttigieg all can draw about as many people as, Hillary Clinton was getting when she started running in 2007.
Wow.
So a lot of people are interested.
Are these the same people, do you think? I mean, is it?
Yeah,
are they going? Are they shopping around? Or are there people going out there? Or are you seeing people who have made up their minds? Like, how much shopping is happening, do you think?
Well, that was the second part of the answer, and I'm glad you asked that one because there is not. I said there's not hard ideology. There really isn't. You meet people all the time who want to go for the candidate they're more familiar with that they think other people would vote for, and you meet, especially at Biden events, some Biden super fans who've loved him forever, but again, there were Hillary Clinton super fans who fell off the wagon in 2007 and 2015. So you meet some of those folks, and you meet a lot more people who just kind of want to see everybody and determine who can win. And I think more in New Hampshire and Iowa, you meet the kind of voters who are unwilling to consider anybody unless they've personally met them and seen them talk and gotten their question answered. That's more specific. I'd say in general, people are pretty happy. I'd say when I ask people if there's anyone they don't think could win or would be running, you do meet people who resent Bernie running again, some hardcore Hillary fans, and you meet some people who, from what they've heard of Tulsi Gabbard, they're not a fan. That's basically it.
Huh. Go ahead. Well, were you going to add something?
And you don't hear a lot of quizzing about policy. You do hear I wrote about this about a month ago. There's a couple efforts underway by the ACLU and by other groups to get people on the record for a number of kind of civil rights priorities. You don't hear that much, "I can't vote for you unless you have this Medicare position." I mean, I've seen, it's something I'm kind of interested in the moment. Like after a lot of people spending time talking to groups and hearing from town halls and having the one questioner who really pushes them, you've kind of seen a halt on the issue demands. It's a lot more, how are you going to stop Trump? And that means everything from what's your agenda to are you electable? There's not as much, I can't support you unless you check this box. Not to minimize what Medicare for All is by saying check the box, but I think you know what I mean.
Yeah. Now, do you anticipate, I mean, where can you compare, I mean, can you compare that to, let's say, to 2016 or to other years? I mean, is this...
Yeah.
I imagine this is fairly atypical, although I can't help but think that maybe it's somewhat reminiscent of 04 on some level. But I don't think you were covering Democratic candidates at that point.
I wasn't. That's a good point. I mean, I've gone back and researched what the crowds were like in local press and this. You could go on C-SPAN and check some things out. But it was similar in that there's just a desire to get Trump out of there, and there's a debate that I've written about where some people just think whoever is most electable, we just need to get them in there. And there are people who are thinking more strategically. I'd say Warren and Sanders in that camp, that even Julian Castro, where you need somebody with a compelling message that would not just win in 2020, but set up the kind of movement the party has not had in a very long time.
Right.
The one that people thought might be there after Barack Obama. You hear that. But from voters, you don't hear as much. And I love talking to voters. It's been interesting. Even, I think, one of the more revealing times I was out there this year was I was in South Carolina the weekend of the bar summary of the Mueller report. And even then, when people were being told that, oh, the thing's over and Trump got off, you didn't hear Democrats saying, I'll only vote for the candidate who's going to impeach him. You heard people saying, oh, well, you know, Southern District of New York, they're going to do their thing. And that was revealing, because people, even if they're hanging on Trump developments on the news, they're not really counting on anything but the election. And it does lead, I really do feel like the dynamic issue debate we had for a while has been paused, because people are scouting out how much these guys look like they can win.
All right. So how are people making that determination? I mean, because, you know, the story right now is, at least the conventional wisdom is, that Joe Biden can win. I mean, do people, when they're assessing Joe Biden, and it just occurred, like the other, what was it that he tweeted? I don't know, the other day, that Donald Trump was not, was atypical of the Republican Party, or
aberrant. He says, the last 4 years can be an aberration, but if Trump wins again, then that's like redefine who we are as a country, which crystallizes, I think, a pretty elite Democratic sentiment. I always think when I hear that sentiment of the person at the Women's March, maybe they've been identified since then, but I never found out, who had a sign saying, you know, if Hillary had won, I'd be at brunch right now. And there's definitely a sort of Democrat who just wants this to be over and has not thought much about permanently changing Washington. And frankly, I haven't figured out the reason why. It's kind of a mystery, because that is the argument that Democrats have really glommed onto in previous elections. Even Bill Clinton made some triangulation efforts in 1992, famously, but there still was a generational change argument. The level of kind of hunching over and hoping that people will just vote for the popular guy, that is unique, and it's been commented on, I think, in the right way.
Well, I mean,
it's also, I'd say, striking, because Biden's crowds are objectively smaller than Sanders and about the same size as Harris and Buttigieg and Warren. I mean, he's for a person being treated like the odds-on front runner, he's old and he's slowed down. His crowds are kind of mediocre. You're not seeing the same fear that you did of like a when Obama really got ahead of steam, was getting thousands of people out to events.
And is he? I mean, I saw some report that when he was in, maybe it was South Carolina, I can't remember, but that he basically over the course of 2 days had two private events and one public event. That doesn't seem like somebody's busting out of the gates, and you know. No. Barnstorming. Give me your sense of that, because I guess what I'm curious about is two things. Is one, is Biden exemplifying in terms of as a candidate the kind of energy, and you know, to hear that his crowds mm-hmm. are just basically typical, mm-hmm. but also not just in terms of like getting that energy, but giving that energy. A and B, I'm curious as to how much people who are coming to see Biden with the assumption that he can win because mm-hmm. they think of Joe Biden as Obama's vice president end up walking away going like, Joe Biden may not be the guy that I think he is.
They're always too nice. I mean, this is something that I think pollsters have studied and they correct for, is people generally don't want to be rude unless they're in a bad mood and they want to talk about it. They tend to be pretty careful. And
is that right? Because that's completely the opposite of me, anyways, as a person.
Yeah, the same with me. But often people, you kind of have to fish around, and I'll ask how they think of Biden, and they'll say, oh, he was good. And then if you prod, they'll say, well, it did seem like he had the trouble getting this one thing out. And no one says, I've been there when he delivered kind of a performance, but a speech where clearly the crowd was not really moving with every part of it. And people kind of come out saying, oh, it was fine. I mean, but you don't see the same head over heels affair that you see after people hear from Buttigieg or Warren, and to an extent Harris. I'm not trying to talk down Harris. I just haven't seen the same. She has some people who come up in as superfans and leave as superfans, some people who think she's not quite ready yet. I mean, I think I'm privileging this because it's the only candidate for whom I've had that actual conversation, and people worrying that she's just not at the performance level of the candidate they think could beat Trump.
Interesting. And so what do people say about Warren in that regard?
It is universally, she's amazing. I'm not sure if she can win. you almost get tired of hearing about it because you hear again and again people saying, oh, she's great. She has all the best ideas. And then they kind of try to rationalize. I mean, there is a really defining characteristic here, is how worried people are about casting that vote that screws over the country in their view by reelecting Trump. And she has not quite she's not quite fixed that, but it's May. This is what now reporters will say, what a losing campaign says, which is like, oh, there's months and anything can happen, but really there haven't been ads, there haven't been debates. So a lot of this is what other campaigns are telling themselves is, yeah, well, they have strong opinions of Biden and Sanders because they've known them for years,
right?
I do not. I have not seen the same thing with other candidates. There's still one thing I've noticed too, which is amazing. I've had to write about is you do encounter people who are just annoyed that there are so many candidates. In the same way that you have the paradox of choice at the grocery store, like, oh, all these choices, this is stressful. You still.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I can that to me makes total sense. And I'm curious as to like from a policy standpoint, or from any, actually, I don't even want to limit it to a policy standpoint, but how are these candidates sort of dividing themselves up in terms of like what lane they're in? Are they doing it on like a policy? Like, I mean, because I mean, for me, I look at it and I go, I see, you know, Bernie and Warren in, you know, perhaps one lane in terms of like, you know, the type of policies. And maybe I'm wrong to exclude others, but that's the way it seems to me. And then there's sort of then things get a little bit murkier, although Biden clearly seems like he's staking out, you know, the furthest to the right in some way just by disdaining all the other policies. It feels like he's just got some hostility, and correct me if I'm wrong. But I wonder, are the campaigns doing it that way? Are voters doing it that way, or do they see other lanes that are more sort of like this is the white guy lane, this is the, you know, the woman lane, or this is the white woman lane, or this is the black person's lane? I mean, how or is it like geographic? I don't know. I'm curious.
I haven't seen people separating the candidates in that way. I mean, it's a useful way to consider them and sort them from D.C., and I'm not saying it's wrong, it's what's happening in D.C., but it's not how voters are interpreting it yet. I mean, you find high information sounds kind of snobby when you're talking about every other voter. Like, they don't have high information. But you do find a kind of voter who watches a lot of MSNBC and reads a lot online and has contrasted the candidates' plans and has come out with a strong opinion. That's just not most of the people showing up. So you might think, oh, well, are they sorting all the moderates into a lane? I don't think they could define who the moderates are, with the exception of somebody who that's all they talk about, like a Michael Bennett. And with a push, I mean, look at some of the crosstabs of these national polls. I tend not to use national polls because there is no national primary, but you're talking about people who are on TV all the time who nationally have like 25% name recognition. Right? It's very easy to tell yourself that, one, these candidates still have a lot of room to introduce, and then two, there's not much sorting going on with voters yet. They need to meet these people. I really think I keep punting, and now after the debates, I have to have strong opinions. But I keep punting until after that. There's some people who just they're not going to see. Even these town halls get a couple, maybe at most, like 2.5 million viewers. And how many of those are in Iowa and New Hampshire? Not that many. Like, there's just a lot of contact they need to make before they sort them out. But they're not doing it in terms of this is the centrist, this is the Irwin. What they do is they've heard that someone's more of a centrist, and Bernie Sanders has shaped kind of the storyline in that way, and Republicans have shaped it too. I mean, I think the president's actually been pretty ineffective at attacking individual Democrats so far this year. I think he's been pretty effective at emphasizing how they're going to run against people, and the idea that, well, Biden's the person he's made the fewest arguments about so far, the person who'd be hardest to tag as a socialist, that has gotten through to people, but they haven't sorted everybody else out.
Interesting. And so are they sorting them? It sounds like the one sorting they're doing at this point is just like their perception of what other people's perception are in terms of their ability to beat Trump.
Yeah, it is. And it sounds like game theory, and that's the best way to think about it. It is not at this moment based on the policy concerns. And I think I wrote a little bit about this in the newsletter yesterday. There's not much talk of foreign policy. It's not this as simple as Bernie thinks he deserves credit and isn't getting it, but it almost is, because there has been a debate about where the party would take the world if they win back the White House. And that's just a lead discussion that's not really connected with average people. I mean, I think it is the ability Trump just gotten has, even after beating him in the midterms, this part surprised me, just the degree to which the president's in Democrats' heads, even as a pretty weak reelection candidate. I mean, I don't remember this much panic about Bush. I don't know why. I think it was just because
about Bush in 2004. You don't remember?
I don't remember this much. Now I remember some of the rationale, like, well, Dean can't beat him, and only Kerry can, and we need Wesley Clark because he's electable. Right. You saw it manifested, and we need somebody with this military bio that he won't be able to attack, which ended up being folly. But you didn't see the same panic that no one else can possibly beat the guy, and then Democrats talked themselves into that right before Iowa. With Trump, it's stranger to me because he already, you know, his peak as a political candidate, the first race was 46% of the vote, and you still see people just kind of nervous about, well, maybe now that we're in competition, but he might have something against this candidate. It's hard to explain because it doesn't connect that directly to the facts that we have about all the candidates.
Well, I mean, part of it is, I would imagine, is that Trump won when he statistically, you know, had a very, very low odds of winning. And I, you know, I think that animates people. And I think broadly speaking, relative to the Bush era, I think that phenomena is not just a function of like the reelect. Like, I personally, I mean, you laugh about that you weren't covering that 2004 election. Sadly, I was exactly in the same position 15 years ago as I am now. And people just didn't have the same level of awareness. I think there was still a lot of fear that in the wake of 9/11, frankly, and sort of the shell shock from getting into this war or the Iraq War at the time. Certainly, the intensity of the fear that he was going to get reelected was there. It just wasn't as broadly shared. which made it very lonely feeling at the time. But let me ask you this, just to get back to that sorting thing. Do the campaigns, to the extent that you know this and you talk to people on the campaigns, do they perceive themselves sorting in lanes that are a function of ideology or in some other mechanism?
The only example I've seen of that is that it is just hard to deny that Elizabeth Warren's support has a ceiling as long as Bernie Sanders is in the race. Ceiling might not be the perfect way to think of it, but had he not run, there was a different theory of the support they were going to be able to corral. There were a lot of Bernie voters who considered the rest of the party, you know, incompetent at challenging not just Trump but Republicanism, and those voters are with Bernie now, which I think has honestly frozen some of the debates that were happening in the field. I mean, there was a utility back in 2018 of being a Democrat showing up to co-sponsor some of Bernie's ideas, and now he's running, so there's no point in doing that. And so what you have instead is maybe people conceding, I don't know, 15-20% of that vote and going elsewhere. Now they're not moving to the center and reaching those voters. And I also, you and I probably agree that the center's just an irritating concept.
Right.
I can show you any numbers of polling that say making Medicare universal buy-in is extremely popular, making the wall is extremely unpopular. And one of those is called a compromise, and one of those is called far left. Right. That's not how it works.
Right.
So you don't see people moving away from popular positions, but you see them just kind of looking for who is gettable, and it's not quite the Bernie people yet. I mean, that's not the way Warren has been framing her campaign. You know, someone like a Klobuchar and a Bennett and a Tim Ryan, you have people saying we're making the Biden argument here about how you need a president who can bring Republicans in on your priorities,
right,
but we're going to do it with somebody who's not like turning 80 in their first term. And they don't say that explicitly, but that's clearly what's going on.
Interesting. And so if I understand you correctly, if Sanders wasn't there, the fight for Sanders voters would be inspiring more candidates, I guess, like presumably like Kamala Harris or Cory Booker or maybe Gillibrand, I guess, to sort of adopt some of these policies that are to the left of where they've been, so as to attract that pool of Bernie voters. But with Bernie there, they basically concede, we're not going to out Bernie, so maybe we try and out young Biden on some level.
Yeah, I think that is happening. I mean, they're not explicit, but the conversations you have with strategists of other campaigns is like, look, we're all waiting for the debates. You can see it if you watch Joe Biden's speech right now. If you want to go to C-SPAN, he's just lost a lot of speed off the pitch, and they just think they have people who are going to be more inspiring to the party's base than the front runner is. And when it comes to issues, I don't think they were sincere. I mean, a lot of ways when they were adopting Bernie's positions. What changed was that whereas in April. We're in May now. In May 2018, a Kamala Harris endorsing Medicare for All meant, oh, great, Medicare for All is gaining steam and the party's going to nominate somebody who agrees with him. And Kamala Harris being for Medicare for All now is the same sort of people say, same sort of people are saying, well, yeah, she's only doing that because she's a phony, and Bernie's the only one who could really bring it forward. And I think that's closed off some of this. I mean, just you don't see the same fight for former Bernie supporters. All that, I should wrap that up and say, you know, he got, for example, 60% of the vote in New Hampshire last time, and he's polling at around 15% now. So a lot of the migration already happened. You just don't see people going, positioning themselves as the true progressive in the race, apart from kind of one slip up Biden quote, because Bernie exists, so we're going to run to something else. And I would say elite Democrats, like electeds and party leaders, do think Bernie is the least electable candidate, and it's based on them saying just in a general election it'd be beating up socialism all the time. For that reason, they think that everyone would be in a better position. Every candidate would have a pretty good position. Anyone who gets it through his primary is going to have defeated the Democratic Socialists, and I think it's going to be probably $1 billion Republican campaign messaging down the tubes.
Right, because they're all going to be people who are seen at to be antagonists of that. But I mean, do you have a sense? Is it possible if you have a sense in terms of like where you're going to get like what the value of that presumed Republican strategy would be? I mean, I understand that it would resonate with the base of the Republican Party, right? Which is older white men and women voters. But they're going to be there for the Republican nominee anyways, right? And presumably the Christian vote for Trump, I don't know how it would be really significantly more energized than in 2016, because there isn't that sort of like open Supreme Court seat that was such a swing seat. I mean,
that's not really a Democrats' control. I mean, there's several scenarios. Let's imagine two big ones, which is one, there's still a 5-4 Supreme Court, and there isn't the same, you have to vote for Trump to change this. There's actually kind of a cockiness that, Trump can't stop talking about how much they already won the courts.
Right.
So you would think logically, just the people who have a qualm don't feel the same impulse to defeat Hillary. But like Republicans like to win. And I'm struck by how much just the memory of Kavanaugh, who got confirmed, remains this huge motivator for the party. So they would say we need a president who's going to continue to fulfill, kind of be your bodyguard if you're an evangelical, who's going to confirm conservative judges and pass these rules protecting your ability to not bake cakes for gay people, or the new rule. I'm still kind of reading, but that's the upshot I assumed. So basically, a bunch of priorities of conservative religious groups that Trump's going to run on them. And unlike in 2016, where there were questions of whether he was sincere, his strategy has been kind of a better base delivery mechanism than any president I've seen. Barack Obama, there were things the base wanted him to do that he resisted because he worried about alienating people. Trump doesn't believe that he can alienate people. He just believes in serving the base. So that'll be the argument. We got a president who God wanted to win and is doing everything that we say. I mean, when I say and God wanted to win, I'm not trying to be glib. I mean, Brad Parscale kind of said so.
Oh yeah,
on Twitter a couple of days ago.
And I think your point, I mean, just today, or I don't know if he did it today, or I guess he made it on Friday, they were writing new rules to allow healthcare providers to be more discriminating in the
that's
types
the
of people.
I'm thinking of.
Yeah, I mean, that's a big, yeah. I remember when George Bush was talking about this for pharmacists. I mean, that's been mm-hmm. and I don't know that he ever came through with it, but Trump is coming through with it. But I guess what I'm asking is, do you have a sense that, that the idea that this is socialism, where this is, we're going to turn into the Soviet Union, is going to resonate with anybody other than the people who are already going to vote for Trump anyways?
I don't think it does. And the point Biden has been making, I think, is pretty inartful, talking about how if it's 4 years as president, it's aberration. The other point he makes that's not an aberration is that this president just doesn't care about anyone outside of his base. I mean, he insists on serving exactly who elected him, and thinking there is enough of a vote there that would elect him again, and has with very little concern of the third party voters who are back with Democrats now. I keep going back to this, and I probably sound monotonous, but I'm amazed. Is the Republicans lost everything in the Midwest in 2018, everything competitive, everything in the state that swung the election, they got wiped out. So instead of dealing with that, the president just kind of retweeting Scott Walker to insist that there's some chicanery that you need to stop. And I feel like there's this whole conversation now about whether he would leave office, et cetera, which seems like a stranger thing to focus on than the voting rules that'll be in place on Election Day 2020. Certainly when I talk to Democratic lawyers, the DNC and stuff, if Trump loses, he loses. What they're worried about is Republican-run states making it more difficult to vote, as we're seeing in Florida, right now.
Right.
And so that is kind of an issue they have to deal with no matter who the nominee is.
Do you have any sense of how people are receiving this sort of message from Nancy Pelosi, which is on one hand, the guy is so dangerous that he may not leave office unless we have a huge victory. And on the other hand, maybe we can make a deal for him on infrastructure. Like, that's it. I mean, to me, that seems like stepping on your own, you know, narrative, right? I mean, it's like a joke on a joke type of thing. Hat on a hat, as they say.
Yeah.
I understand why I get that, but do people on the camp, do voters, are they even keyed into that? I mean, who is that for, if not for voters? Or who, like, why is she doing that? Do you have any sense?
Wait, I missed the part of the question. Why is she doing what?
Well, Pelosi, where she's saying on one hand, the guy is so dangerous that he may not leave office, right? Which, I don't remember any politician ever saying that about another politician, frankly.
Yeah.
And then
I think the point she was trying to make was that this is a president who always cast doubt on the integrity of the election. The way that Democrats dealt with that in 2018 was just beating him so badly in the House that he couldn't say anything. And so it was kind of, so it's become an elite question to ask again, because there's a certain donor mindset that never made sense to me. The same brain spasms that made people say in 2016, well, Trump doesn't really want to win. Trump will drop out if it gets hard. It's the same attitude that says, well, maybe Trump will never leave office. Maybe the people, and it frustrates Democrats. It frustrates Democrats because, like I was saying before, they see a lot more proximate threats to whether the election will be fair or not than like the fantasy story. But I think it is an elite conversation, and my sense was it crept into it. I mean, I think it's something Bill Maher says all the time. So it crept into this interview. It's become kind of a fun question to ask Democrats, like, but do you think Trump would concede if he lost? And that's the way she chose to answer it.
Yeah.
I don't think it's a manifestation of a lot of things Democrats are thinking right now.
Okay.
Except in that there's just always that pool of people, and they're on Twitter too, who just, rather than dealing with the reality of the campaign, are like, but what about this fantasy scenario? What about Voldemort?
I will say that I will cop to A, not being a donor, but B, part of donor class. But B, I thought that Trump would drop. I never thought he wanted to be president. And I'm not sure that the reporting is contrary to that. I don't think he thought he was going to win necessarily. And I think if he leaves, he's going to do it with the most aggrieved possible way, because that sets up a business opportunity after the fact, it seems to me. But I guess I was just like curious as to if people are registering this sort of this sort of mixed message of Pelosi, which I perceive as a mixed message, and maybe you're saying it's not really that strong of a message or that deliberate of like he's the worst ever, but we shouldn't impeach him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess that has gotten across because. It's almost, what would I compare it to? Jeez, I was about to make a terrible Marvel reference, which I actually think would make sense. But it's close your ears if you haven't seen the biggest movie in the world yet, the Avengers 4. But there's a magic weapon that's used, and then after it's used, the user destroys it so it can't be used again. And that's almost the way that impeachment worked in 1998. Whereas Republicans used it, they got exactly what they needed to. In terms of discrediting Clinton and making voters exhausted with him and setting up the narrative that George Bush would bring us back to decency. And then having used it, people just have such traumatic memories of how stupid the whole thing was. They don't want to use it again. They hear impeachment. I'm convinced people just don't know what impeachment is. I mean, like, when you tell people that two presidents have been impeached, they don't believe you because they think it means that they're removed from office. What I'm surprised Democrats aren't doing is taking the step that Democrats did in 1973 and Republicans did in 2000, very different situation, 2013, of just creating a select committee to investigate something.
Right.
Republicans did this with Benghazi. There was a Watergate committee. That's most of the things you've heard, frankly, on Watergate were from the Watergate investigation in Congress, not from the impeachment committee. The impeachment was a House committee. When you talk about Sam Ervin and Fred Thompson and all that, they were in the Senate. So there's just a there's a belief that the Jerry Nadlers of the world, et cetera, can keep focusing on this, and that is going to get the point across more than impeachment fight, because people don't know what impeachment is, and it's just, you know, why drag yourself into it? Which it does seem completely defeatist. And I think one reason that Warren did very well in polling in the last 2 weeks was that she was, you know, I think this is one of her strengths in general. She was never a politician until 2013. Like, she never ran for anything until she was in her 60s. She's not absorbed sort of politician think and like, well, if I make this point, then 13 moves down the line, I could lose my queen and my rook. She just kind of read it and said, okay, this report says he committed impeachable offenses. And I think people listened to that, thought that was bold and straightforward, and took another look at her. That's my sense of what happened recently. Not that they all agreed, yes, we should impeach, just that, okay, here's somebody who's dealing with the facts.
Interesting. Well, Dave Weigel, it's fascinating stuff. People can read your dispatches from the trail by signing up for the trailer at Washington. Yeah. And, of course, read your articles. Dave, always a pleasure. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
All right, folks. Dave Weigel, Washington Post. We will turn to Dave from time to time as the campaign moves on. I mean, I think the interesting thing is that we, you know, 2 months ago, was it even 2 months ago? We were like, Kamala Harris, whoa, what a what gangbuster. And now it's not, I mean, I think
we were giving people a little too much credit, I think.
Well, I think there is, you know, it takes a little bit of time to get back into sort of like the modality of thought of a campaign, which is when the new person jumps in, they're always most interesting. And then they rise and fall. And it's definitely worthwhile to go back and look at polling. You know, this time in 2004, Joe Lieberman was in the lead for the polls. He did not turn out to do so well, much to my enjoyment.
Did he actually say Joe Mentum, or was that a joke that somebody did about him?
I feel like, I don't know. You gotta go back and read Atreos, basically. I would imagine any type of like meme like that, it generally would come from Atreos's site. But I do think that we're going to have a much better sense of what things are after a couple of debates. And so what? We shall see.
Pulled the wrong tab over.
Yeah. Matt is like really knee deep into statistical analysis.
Literary hangover just got approved for monetization on YouTube. So feeling pretty happy.
So that's awesome. So that's just the way it got. They just.
Yeah,
no,
they give you some. Exactly.
You doing some videos?
Yeah. I might start doing some live streams now.
Ooh.
Nice.
But we will check in with Dave. In the meantime, what we're going to do is head into the fun half, folks, and remind you that this program relies on your support every single day. You can become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. What do you get? Extra content. You get the ability to support the show that you listen to on a regular basis. And you get it all commercial free. So go to jointhemajorityreport.com, become a member. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code majority, get 10% off. Also, a reminder, you can take a leap into the future with Capterra.com. It's the leading free online resource to help you find the best software solution for your business. With over 750,000 reviews of products from real software users, Capterra can help you make an informed decision no matter what your business needs. Visit capterra.com/majority for free today. Noodle around on the site. Find the right tools to make 2019 the year for your business. capterra.com/majority. Capterra, that's capterra.com/majority. Today is Monday. Tomorrow night will be Tuesday. What will be happening on Tuesday night, Michael?
Indeed. At 6 p.m. before the main show, we're going to do a live stream with Mike Hanna on the South African elections, which are coming up on May 8th. And then in the main show, Renique Allen is joining us to talk about her new book. And then Ben Burgess is going to join us in studio to talk about logic, emotions, and how to win a left-wing argument. All that and, of course, a lot more. Patreon.com/TMBS, Michael Brooks Show on YouTube, and check out the new Illicit History of International Law with Kristen Pear Anderson.
Jamie.
This week on the Antifada, we have unlocked our new series, Prolet Cult. It's producer AP Andy talking about UFOs, conspiracy theories, and the paranormal from a Marxist and sociological perspective. So that's unlocked today. If you're not a patron, you can listen to it anyway. Also, we recorded an episode with Katie Halper over the weekend talking about the 90s, from all the goofy pop culture we associate with the 90s to how the politics and economics of the 90s have prefigured a lot of the things that are happening right now. So that'll be out on Wednesday. I also wanted to plug, I'm going to be appearing at Katie Halper's live show that she is doing with Struggle Session. Indeed. And that is this Friday, May 10th at Littlefield in New York City at 8 p.m. It's going to be Katie Halper and Struggle Session along with special guests Matt Taibbi, Jamie Peck, that's me, and Jake Flores. So if you're in the area, come check it out.
Matt? Coming up on Saturday is The Song of Hiawatha by Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. A lot of people might think it's pronounced Hiawatha, but it's pronounced Hiawatha. It was one of the most famous poems of the middle of the 19th century.
Where's the board again, Sam?
And and it's by Henry Wadsworth Longfellow.
Wait, you say it's Hiawatha.
Hiawatha.
Wow.
And we talk about it as a sort of example of the sort of noble savage myth and sort of romanticizing Native Americans and also being sort of inevitabilist about how we're going to take the land from them. But I also found a New York Times review of the poem at the time. And it says this, it's like as if Barry Weiss was writing for them at the time. As an Indian saga, embalming pleasantly enough the monstrous traditions of an uninteresting and, one may almost say, a justly exterminated race, the Song of Hiawatha is entitled to commendation. So yeah, that was the reception it got at the time.
Jesus.
My brain is still in recovery mode.
Oh, also,
taking on so many important high-level ideas.
Well, look, you got to listen. Just that's one opinion. And if we shut that out, then we can't get that sense of a perspective.
Yeah, and I also introduced a game called How Racist Was Edgar Allan Poe? So you can check out that.
Oh, dear.
Yeah,
it's hard out here for a Jewish anarchist goth.
I love how we're doing games now on Literary Hangover. Yeah. Literary Hangover has entered the game phase. I like it.
Gamification of...
All my faves are so problematic as a gothic American.
Poe was very problematic, yeah.
All right, folks. See you in the fun half. Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
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 You want to smoke this joint?